Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the fight for civil rights in America change as a result of Martin Luther King's stint in Bull Connor's Birmingham jail? King expected to be arrested on Good Friday of 1963 for violating a city ban on demonstration marches. What he did not expect was a searing statement published in the Birmingham newspaper by a group of white clergymen who considered themselves racial moderates but nevertheless denounced King and his colleagues as extremist outsiders whose demands for equality were untimely. As my guest today will tell us, King's remarkable response to that piece began with notes scribbled on the paper's margins and eventually blossomed into the document known today as the Letter from Birmingham Jail. He begins by laying out arguments for white Americans to support black civil rights and then shifts dramatically to an expression of his outrage and disappointment that so few had taken action to do so. Jonathan Ryder is professor of sociology at Barnard College, Columbia University. His book, Gospel of Freedom, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Letter from Birmingham Jail and the Struggle That Changed a Nation, is available now in paperback. And Jonathan Ryder will be in town Monday for the Dallas Institute's MLK Symposium at City Performance Hall. Jonathan, welcome to Think.
Delighted to be here.
You write that King was an expressive man who often hid his passion behind a mask of dignity. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you look at King's preaching and his addresses to white folks, they often have a certain formal quality if you compare it in particular to the preaching style of Daddy King, for example. But you always, and he was a man, again, of great manners. And even the way the letter from Birmingham jail starts, you know, my dear fellow clergyman, it has this precious gentility to it. And throughout, he says, you know, I regret and lamentably, he's the most polite and courteous and a man of kind of great gravitas. And yet with King, you always feel the passions bubbling right below the surface and often, as we know, breaking right through it.
So part of what makes this letter from Birmingham jail so astonishing is that halfway through it, King, if he doesn't take the gloves off, certainly he drops that mask and reveals this deep anger, not only at the injustices faced by black Americans, but by the incredibly slow pace of progress. Can you talk a little bit about why we've sort of allowed ourselves to forget King's anger?
Well, I think that race has never stopped being a difficult issue for American life. It's the great threat to our self-image as a democratic nation. We begin as a nation in slavery, so we're a white people's democracy. And for those who hew to a vision of American exceptionalism, that we're so special, our destiny is freedom, this is the great contradiction in the nation's soul, and it almost split the nation in half in a civil war. So in many ways, in the years after the civil rights movement, which made unbelievable, undeniable progress, there was a desire, I think, for Americans to look on the sunny side. Look at all that we've done. That's back in history. And so this idea of a sunny Dr. King, King the Dreamer, reassures us that all that nasty muck and stuff is back in history and can lead to a kind of smug and self-congratulatory way of celebrating Dr. King, which certainly would not be compatible with his image of what his identification with the prophets of the Bible was all about.
When you say that, you know, the image that we've created of the sunny king reassures us, by us, do you mean white America specifically?
Well, white America, but to some extent, great portions of black America as well, but especially white America. But there's a generation of African-American people who don't know King necessarily, except from this sunny celebration on precisely days like the MLK holiday. So I think it goes way beyond white people, but I think it's America in general.
So give us a little bit of background on Birmingham 1963. Surely the majority of its black residents wished for better lives, but expressing that desire even was a really dangerous thing to do there.
Well, I think Birmingham puts into context, because it leads to a swerve in the civil rights movement that, in fact, will become in 2 years, meaning 50 years ago now, Selma, Alabama. Selma is simply a repeat with some tweaking of what King and his colleagues learned in Birmingham, and in a way, it's applied letter of Birmingham jail. So Birmingham was a viciously racist town presided over by a virulently racist lawman and a mayoral political establishment that suppressed all possibility of black mobilization. And it was known as Bombingham. And to some extent, Dr. King understood in January of 1963, when a small band of his closest colleagues were in a retreat and they were deciding, we're going all in Birmingham. King looked around that table and he said, I want you to think about something. You know, Bull Connor, the lawman, he's not playing. Some of us may not come back from Birmingham. And as Andrew Young tried to put it to me, he said what Dr. King was doing was forcing us to accept the possibility of our own death. And so going into Birmingham, everybody understood what would be involved, and they planned to build up to, you know, the major focus of that demonstration on Good Friday. And so they went in as serious Christians. They were not people for whom Jesus Christ was just a merely interesting historical figure. These were pious men, God-intoxicated, as King put it. They understood the symbolism of Easter very well, and they understood that they might suffer as their Savior did up on the cross. And that sacrificial imagery is very important to their understanding of what they would do. We may suffer so others can be free. So Birmingham was a fearsome, just demonically frightening town, and they were going up against the worst. And what they felt was, if we could break segregation in Birmingham, the walls of segregation would come tumbling down. And in ways they didn't utterly anticipate, that actually is what happened, because Birmingham really led to a turnaround by John Kennedy, who stopped avoiding the issue of race, and it started the momentum towards the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Without Birmingham, you don't get to that. I have the March on Washington or the Civil Rights Bill, and then you don't get to Selma and the Voting Rights Bill of 65.
So they expected fierce resistance from the white power structure in Birmingham. What kind of reception did King and his colleagues receive from the black community in Birmingham?
Oh, wonderful question. And, you know, King understood something about oppression. And he, again, as a man who was deeply, who took biblical stories in metaphor, not as metaphor, as John Lewis once told me, as he walked over the bridge in Selma, it wasn't as if we were walking across the River Jordan. We were walking across the Jordan. And so King knew the Exodus story, and he knew that the Israelites in the wilderness were murmured and they longed to go back to the flesh pots of Egypt. And so when King came to town, it wasn't as if the black churches and black people all rose up immediately around the great leader. There was a black upper middle class or middle class of professional and business people who were very cautious, and they didn't want to. They were nervous about the idea of these outsiders coming in. There were local movement people who felt, oh, the big guy from Atlanta's coming in. So, and then there was just the fear. And again, probably 90 or 95% of the churches did not support King's movement. There were a handful of churches that were the core of this kind of activist Christianity. So King became very despondent. And you can hear him even before, because as he starts trying to mobilize the community in March, things are not going well. And he's becoming disenchanted with blacks. And you can hear him sometimes bitter in the mass meetings in which he will say, no freedom-loving black person of any self-respect will break the boycott. Well, that's his way of criticizing blacks who are not joining in as not having self-respect. And he says they are traitors to their race. And in March, when he preaches about this back in Atlanta, he tells the story of Moses going to God. And Moses says, the children of Israel are murmuring. They want you to take them to the promised land. And then King, who's assuming God's voice, says, and you can hear the irritation, as if the burden is all on God or all on Martin King, tell the Israelites to go forward. I can't do it all myself. So King's initial decision to go to jail on Good Friday starts from the faltering, the lack of spirit in the black movement, in the sense that they're going to fail. It's all slipping away, and he's got to do something dramatic. And he's very disappointed in black people, even before he's read this statement by the white preachers. And that's weighing on him heavily as he goes to prison. And if you look at the picture, there's a picture of Ralph Abernathy, Reverend Abernathy, Fred Shuttlesworth, the local black church leader in Birmingham, who had really created the Birmingham movement before King arrived. He'd been fighting racism for a decade. And King, the three of them are striding next to one another. And there's a kind of, not twinkle in Abernathy's expression, but there's something, he's at peace. And you can see Shuttlesworth, who's just bold and defiant and afraid of no man. And King looks troubled. He looks anxious. And so all of those anxieties about blacks coming and responding to his call, all those things are weighing heavily on him as he heads towards that jail.
Jonathan Ryder is my guest. He's professor of sociology at Barnard College and author of The Gospel of Freedom, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Letter from Birmingham Jail and the Struggle That Changed a Nation. He'll be in town Monday for the Dallas Institute's MLK Symposium at City Performance Hall. Back in 2 minutes with Jonathan Ryder.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
And dogs, well, I tell you, when I was growing up, I was dog bitten for nothing. So I don't mind being bitten by a dog for standing up for freedom. Now, I was down in going to court the other day when we were in jail, and they took us into the city hall for court under ground. And I looked over there and saw a tank. A tank was sitting over there, and I didn't know what to do. I said, what is that? Somebody said, well, that's Bull Connor's tank, and you know it's a white tank. Now, I want to say tonight that they can bring their dogs out, they can get their water, and even Bull Connor can get his white tank, and our black faces will stand up before the white tank.
That was the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. speaking at a meeting in Birmingham on May 3rd, 1963, just weeks after he wrote from Birmingham City Jail. My guest this hour is Jonathan Ryder, professor of sociology at Barnard College and author of Gospel of Freedom, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Letter from Birmingham Jail and the Struggle That Changed a Nation. He'll be in town Monday for the Dallas Institute's MLK Symposium at City Performance Hall. Jonathan, I love that recording, which I hadn't heard before this week. For one thing, King is defiant, but he's also speaking in a much more natural way than most of the astonishing and wonderful recordings we hear of him, but the ones that make him seem almost superhuman. He's a real person when he's speaking on May 3rd, 1963.
You know, I had the same response when I first discovered that recording. And one of the things that I've tried to do in Gospel of Freedom is understand the letter not only as a philosophic document, but as a cry of black pain and anger and put it back in the context of the struggle. And so I was very lucky that the people at the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute were able to connect me to this wonderful trove of recordings that you can hear King in all his many moods and modes. And it's a different King who's revealed when he's with black people in those churches. And as you say, you hear that defiance. This is just hours after Bull Connor used the dogs and the fire hoses for the first time. And when King starts that first talk, he's not defiant. He's almost silent. He's stunned. And he sometimes will talk slowly in that preacher way as he's getting geared up. But this is almost stunned by white depravity. And he says, "Today was a mean day in Birmingham. Birmingham was a mean city. They were mean to us." It's almost like a kid's simplicity. All he can say, "They were mean to us." And as he goes on, you hear his fight come back. And he says, "They can get their dogs and they can get their hoses, but our black faces will stand up to their white tanks." This is a man who is a tough freedom fighter as well as an ambassador of love. And as you say, there's the down-home part of him. He and his preacher buddies, when they were together, they would slip into the vernacular. They were politically incorrect jokesters. And that was a very important part of King, but he didn't like to show that. Only his closest colleagues would see that most of the time, and other black people would see that. But in the same way, he was a great jokester and mimic, and he would tell stories about he liked to preach his own funeral and the funeral of his colleagues. And he would say things like, "Now, y'all think," and I'm imitating Andrew Young's accent doing this story, "Now, y'all think the Klan is going to get me, but y'all be jumping out in front of the camera and they're going to get you, but I will preach you the best funeral you ever had." And then he'll preach their funerals, and he would pick on some little foible of each of his colleagues and make fun of them of what he would say at their funeral. So he was hilarious, a great imitator, and as I use a phrase, and not out of disrespect, but I think it humanizes him, he was a badass in certain ways. And he had, again, could be quite irreverent, the irreverent reverend when he was off stage, as it were.
Jonathan, why was King placed in solitary confinement in Birmingham?
Okay, so the solitary confinement is really important to what's going on. In King's mood, we know how fragile he was going on. And we know that as King and Abernathy were thrown in the police car by Bull Connor's people, they overheard Bull Connor saying, "Let's separate them." And when King was in jail, he was usually there with his buddy Abernathy, who stabilized him, gave him solace, as it were. And that King had a great fear and even a panicky fear of being in jail alone. He had had a very traumatic experience in Georgia in which he thought he was going to be killed. So on some level, Connor understood that separating the two of them and putting him alone might break him. Connor was trying to break him. And in fact, King spirals down into depression and despondency and panic. And he writes later, "These were the most terrifying events, the darkest days of my life." And he's in a deep depression, and he's scared, and he's lost his fight. And it's almost as all the disappointment in black people, all of the anger, John Kennedy, for always saying, "Later, later, not now, we'll get to you, but the time is not ripe." He hasn't eaten. All of this comes to a head in the darkness of his cell. And that's where he is when he first gets that criticism by the 8 white moderate clergymen of Alabama telling him that their movement is untimely and they should have waited and that they were precipitating violence. So that is a critical part of the story. You've got to picture King in the darkness looking up, not the strong leader, but the very human leader, the prophet who can be fallible and weak.
So the point is that he had obviously taken much harsher criticism from much more sort of pitched enemies in the past. But at this moment in his life, that was like more than he could take, that letter from the supposedly moderate preachers of Birmingham.
I think you put it well. And King, a black trustee, sneaks King the newspaper, and King is there in this panic, in this depression, and he reads this story of the, and he reads the criticism. And again, the one rabbi and the seven Christian clergymen, and these were considered the most enlightened racially, and in a way they crystallize all of his growing anger at all the people who've been saying wait. He's exploded at John Kennedy a year before in Albany, Georgia. Robert Kennedy has told the movement, we don't want you to go forward. You're going to mess up the political environment. We're going to lose the White South to the Republican Party. Well,
that did in fact happen.
But you can, so people have been telling him to wait. And when King preaches about that moment that he reads this statement in a black church 48 hours after getting out of Birmingham jail, and I'm one of the few people who've heard this. It's an amazing black version of the letter. And what he says is, and I read where, now in the letter he addresses the ministers and preacher, my dear fellow clergyman, when he's preaching to this black audience fresh from jail, he says, and I read where these preachers are saying we're naughty. Wait, why don't you wait? And you hear the anger overcoming him. That's all we've ever heard. Wait for a more convenient season. So, in fact, Wyatt Walker, who was the executive director and a key organizer in Birmingham for King's organization, the way he phrased it is, his cup of endurance runneth over. Hmm. And so suddenly King owed these clergymen, because he was then, he read this, and suddenly he's rising up out of the valley of fear and depression on this tide of indignation. And he's going to answer them, and that anger all will flow into that indignation, because it's a moral anger. It's an anger at injustice and an anger at Christian people in particular who purport to believe in the Bible and Jesus and God's love will not come out and say, obey desegregation, not just because it's the law, but because the Negro is your brother. And suddenly King is going up that mountain on this tide of indignation. And that's where the letter is born. And he's writing on toilet tissue and on the side of newspapers. And then it's being smuggled out to Wyatt Walker, who's overseeing its writing at the office in Birmingham.
It's remarkable how many historical and literary allusions are contained within the letter. And he didn't have, you know, you mentioned he was writing on toilet paper. He didn't have his books with him to craft this thing.
Well, crafting is a good word here, because King, he wasn't a bad writer, but he was really a talker and a speaker. And if you notice in I Have a Dream, the most passionate, powerful part of I Have a Dream is when he throws down the prepared speech halfway through and basically starts improvising. And he wasn't going to do I Have a Dream that day. It was too long. But suddenly the Spirit of the Lord is upon him. And the Word, it's the Word, the spoken Word. And if you notice, when you look at the newsreels of that day at the March on Washington, and until then, he's reading, because it's a very important political moment. He's being very careful and cautious. But then that arm comes up to the right, and he's looking up, and he's in church. And so King loved, as Andrew Young again said it, he said, if King could have preached the letter to the white clergy, that's how he would have answered them. So the way to think of the letter is, in many ways, it is a total amalgam. It's this composite of all the fragments of his preaching and orating over the years. I can identify most paragraphs where he's spoken them before, all these phrases, but he's constantly mixing and remixing and sampling himself and others and binding all of this. And so the way I think of this, this is really a written version of talk. And it comes, and that's why it often, despite the writing, gets the rhythmic quality. And you, again, you know when he's preaching under the guise of answering their the clergyman with fancy philosophy. But this should be seen primarily as a prophetic sermon. Even though it takes the form of a prophetic letter, it's really a sermon. He's preaching to the world, not just those eight clergy.
Jonathan Ryder is my guest. He's professor of sociology at Barnard College, Columbia University, and author of the book Gospel of Freedom, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Letter from Birmingham Jail and the Struggle That Changed a Nation. The book is out now in paperback. Jonathan Ryder will be in town Monday for the Dallas Institute's MLK Symposium at the City Performance Hall. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Barnard College sociology professor Jonathan Ryder, author of Gospel of Freedom, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Letter from Birmingham Jail and the Struggle That Changed a Nation. He'll be in town Monday for the Dallas Institute's MLK Symposium at City Performance Hall. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Jonathan, the Letter from Birmingham Jail is now widely anthologized. You can find it online. It's taught in schools. What was done with it in the immediate days and months and weeks after it was written?
Well, let's look at this in a couple of ways. There were people in King's inner circle who didn't understand why he was spending all this time answering a bunch of white preachers. That, you know, we're trying to run a social movement. We're trying to liberate black people. And, you know, Doc, as they often called him, Dr. King, he's like lost it. His cup of endureth runneth over, but keep his eye on the prize. So, you know, not everybody understood, even in his circle, the momentousness of what he was doing at the time. And so when he gets out of jail, he probably was tweaking it a little bit after he got in out of jail, but they maintain at least the fiction that it was written entirely in jail. I think it was mainly written in jail, but there was a little bit of editing probably. It was given out to reporters in mimeograph form, and reporters weren't that impressed with it. And, you know, it appeared only gradually in some very small publications. The Quakers published a version of it called Tears of Love towards the end of May, and some small religious magazines published bits of it. But it was really Christian Century that published it in full in June, which was a sign that the core institution, media institution of establishment Protestantism was taking heed of it as an important message. So again, it took, you know, it had its own biography in a sense, and the people who actually won the day in Birmingham were those young people who burst out the doors of 16th Street Baptist Church and went up against Bull Connor. They hadn't read the letter, but they were embodying and acting out the themes of the letter, which is the morality of standing up to injustice. And, you know, we need to be co-workers with God against injustice and not wait for the Lord to carry us to the promised land.
We should note King's arrest and the letter came months before the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church that famously killed four little girls. King publicly called for calm in the wake of that crime, and there was a great desire among many people at that point to strike back with violence.
Well, we see here what was a tension within the Christian nonviolent movement and the larger black community from the beginning. Dr. King was a realist. He didn't think that moral appeal alone could win justice in America. That's why he thought it required Birmingham's and Selma and political pressure. And he himself says in the letter, he's very realistic. He does not have a naive view of moral argument in his own preaching to effect white change. He said, it's a sad fact, but privileged groups rarely give up their privileges voluntarily. And he says, I've come to the regrettable conclusion that members of the oppressor race can rarely understand the groans and suffering of the oppressed race. He's saying that groups are immoral often, even if individuals have the capacity for moral awakening. So you have to put all of that sort of into the equation as we think about the unfolding of this process over time.
Let's go to the phones now. We have Bob on the line in Fort Worth. Hello, Bob.
Hi, Chris. I was sitting here listening to you, and I couldn't help but wonder how King addressed the white supremacist view, how the white theologians reconciled their religious belief with their position of inequality between the black man and the white man, and furthermore, how the white theologians reconciled the Constitution that created, you know, gave all men equal rights. I just wondered how King saw that and how he addressed it.
Thanks for your call.
You know, we have to think back to that time, and it's one of the most regrettable parts of this tawdry history of racism and slavery in America, that evangelical Christianity in the South often provided the rationale for segregation. And Ralph Reed, one of the great organizers of the Christian right in the 80s and 90s, more in the 90s, Ralph Reed, as a spokesman for evangelicals, said, "We as evangelicals on the right have to repent and atone because we often were in the forefront of justifying segregation." So King understood that, but he really focused on the more established liberal denominations because he thought there they accepted the theological principles that King in his preaching always went back to St. Paul. In Christ, there is no East nor West, no freeman nor bondsman. And if you notice in the letter, he will appeal to Jewish authorities, Martin Buber, and he will quote Paul Tillich, the Protestant. Isn't sin separation? What is more separating than segregation? And St. Thomas Aquinas said, it's a sin, anything that doesn't elevate human personality. Well, racism and segregation devalue human personality. So King understood that that great middle of America theology is on his side. And part of his indignation and frustration is their failure to live up to their own theological beliefs. And what he's doing in the letter in the first half, when he's still trying to explain to them, in a way he's saying, here's the principle we agree on as religious people. And from that, we agree on what is the deduction from that, that all human beings are worthy in God's eyes, and that's incompatible with segregation. Therefore, why won't you speak up? And King's indictment of that middle of America, both not just the religious body, but most ordinary Americans, is not that they are racists, but they sit on the sidelines, they hide behind stained glass windows, they prefer caution to conscience. And in a way, the sermon that emerges as he drops explaining and starts chastising in the second half of Letter from Birmingham Jail is his way of saying, how can you call yourself a good Christian and not speak out? Because the Christian's role and the Jew's role is not simply not to do wrong. You have an obligation to come to the Macedonian call for aid, to minister to your brother on the Jericho Road. You have an obligation to speak up against suffering, not simply to remain silent. And what King says, therefore, it's not only a critique of theology, it's the failure to live up to your theology. And in a way, he's sort of saying what Malcolm X, in a much more street version, said when he talked about white trichnology. King is saying there's a lot of white hypocrisy within American religion. You're not practicing what you preach.
Jonathan, Americans today are rightly proud of Martin Luther King and the values that he stood for and the people who carry on his legacy. What do we miss, though, if we reduce our understanding of him years after his death to a sort of saintly but one-dimensional figure?
Well, there may be some human longing and need. I'll leave it to the shrinks to figure this out for perfect heroes. But we always, I think, go wrong when we over sort of make heroes of human beings, because it suggests that their actions are so powerful and exceptional that we couldn't possibly do what they do. And for King, his preaching in church, his orating in Selma and Birmingham and Albany, Georgia, was really about the exceptional capabilities of all human beings. You have a responsibility to free yourself. We can all be co-workers for God. We can all appeal to our neighbor on the Jericho Road. So he would have, I'm not saying he didn't sometimes encourage hero worship. He was, he sometimes saw himself as equivalent of Jesus and Amos. So he had a strong, sometimes grand sense of himself. But his fundamental belief was all of us are responsible for bettering the world. So that's one problem with hero worship. But the other thing that's important is we forget the fundamental religious conviction of King, which is he would have looked back on all they accomplished and been proud. And he was in the speech before he's assassinated in Memphis. He looks back and said, oh, I'm so glad I didn't sneeze when I had that knife in me. I would have died. I wouldn't have been there to watch the people of Birmingham rise up. I wouldn't have been there to tell the people about the dream. I wouldn't have been there in Selma when we brought the nation a voting rights bill. So he's proud of everything. And he would have looked back on all the strides of America with immense pride. But he was a half-glass empty guy because that was his theology, which is there is always Egypt's. And there are always Jews in bondage, whatever they are called in whatever nation. Dives and Lazarus was his great sermon. There are always people, the gimpy, poor beggar oozing with lesions. And the rich man, what is Dives' sin? It's not that he has wealth. Wealth is a fine thing. King says the Bible never said it's bad to be wealthy. It's that he walks past that suffering beggar and does not see him. And so King would have focused on all the ways in which suffering in the nation and the world continues. So even if he would have said, we've made great strides, he would have said, the word of the Lord is upon me. I've been anointed to heal the sick and deliver the captives and preach to those who are in jail. And so I think we betray the message of King, whether we're religious or secular people, if we don't understand what is our unfinished business.
Jonathan,
and what is our obligation to finish what is unfinished?
Jonathan Ryder is professor of sociology at Barnard College, Columbia University. His book, Gospel of Freedom, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Letter from Birmingham Jail and the Struggle That Changed a Nation, is available now in paperback. He'll be in town Monday for the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture's MLK Symposium at City Performance Hall. Jonathan, it's been such an interesting hour. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Do I have 30 more seconds? I just want to say very quickly, if you come to the Dallas Institute on Monday, you will see the 67th Book of the Bible. It's a play by a local graduate of Booker T. Washington High School and SMU. And it's not going to be just me speechifying. You got a real powerful drama. And it's 7 p.m. at Dallas City Performance Hall down in the Arts District. I really hope everybody will come out because you got a really special night the Dallas Institute folks have put together for you.
We'll look forward to it. Thanks so much, Jonathan.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks to all of you for listening. Thank you so much.